Hello and welcome to the Leaders Council Podcast, the podcast for the people who run the country and the people who keep the country running. You join us in yet another overcast day here in the capital. I'm Matthew O'Neill, and today, as always, we ensure that we have a variety of distinct perspectives on leadership. First, we're joined by Richard Keyes, Chief Executive of TC Group, a professional services group made up of accountants, IFAs, and lawyers that advise owner-managed businesses. As of August 2020, the business is the fastest-growing group in the UK. Richard, hello.
Hi, Matthew.
Thank you very much for coming on the program today. Normally we'd get straight into the subject of leadership, but considering the ongoing COVID outbreak, let's start there. How has this affected your company?
I guess directly for us, it's had the obvious effect is that most of our staff have had to move to working from home instead of from the office. So we've got circa 240 staff across the group, 200 of those are in the UK. So pretty much overnight, like most businesses, they've had to move to working from home. But I think indirectly, our core job, as you said in the intro there, is to look after owner-managed businesses. And we work across a number of different sectors. So there's a number of clients, as you'll appreciate, and your listeners will appreciate, have needed much more support. So a lot of our time, instead of just doing the compliance work or the more forward-facing advisory work, we've had to spend a lot of time making sure clients well looked after, and that the information that's come out of the government has been reviewed by us and articulated to them so that they've been able to continue trading. So yeah, it's been probably the busiest period we've had since I've been involved in the group. But I think on the most part, a lot of our clients have, as a result of that and the government measures, been able to trade so far through COVID. And if they continue trading, obviously their clients have asked, so that's good for us. So touch wood, so far most of our clients have been okay, but we've spent a lot of time helping them get through all different government measures.
Now, of course, this has been very difficult for many businesses and will have quite a lot of long-term effects. Do you feel that this particular situation is going to have a long-term effect on your business in particular?
I would probably, similar to my first answer, directly I would say no, in that for the businesses and the wider economy, privately owned businesses will always need the services that we provide. But of course, our client base, our owner managed businesses, and there's certain sectors in there that without government support are going to struggle. The leisure and retail sector, the obvious ones currently, but I think also the commercial property sector next year will have a similar challenge. So those sectors will be affected, which will indirectly affect our business to a point. But we're a growing business and we have mechanisms to grow. So I don't think directly it will be detrimental to us. And we tend to merge and acquire smaller professional firms as well. So I think for a lot of those, because of their IT and their support functions aren't at the same scale as ours, so they've struggled to carry on supporting clients. So it's actually enabled us to do deals more quickly with those firms. Mm-hmm. So I think directly for us, it probably, if I was to weigh it all up, we consider this positive in that we can now work from home. So that's been a good advantage for us. And we've also been able to put deals together. But I think for our client base, there will be sections of it where it doesn't end well. And we're going to have to help them look at options probably early next year when the government's going to start to tail off. So mixed bag, really. Some good and some bad. But I think on the most part, we'll be fine. And a lot of people in our profession will be fine. But it depends on how many of their clients get through to next year and are able to trade for it.
We should move on to the subject of leadership. I always like to start this part of the conversation with the same simple question. What does the word leader mean to you?
I can only answer it in the context of our business. I haven't got any expertise outside of that. So for us, we as a business, as a profession, I would say, have lots of challenges like any sector does, and I think leadership is taking the time to understand those challenges in the sort of medium and long term, because technology is a big challenge for our sector, definitely a big opportunity as well, but definitely a big challenge. So leadership contextually in the business that I'm in, we have to in our head office spend a lot of time understanding what might be coming around the corner so that we can start to plan for how to take advantage of that and not be affected adversely by it. So for me, leadership is about long-term planning and then the ability to execute those plans.
Now, of course, everyone has a different sort of leadership style. How would you describe yours?
We're fairly unusual in terms of a professional services group. If you look at a lot of accountancy or law firms of our size, they would be centrally controlled. And what I mean by that is all of the partners that report into that business will sit on a board, and there'd be a managing partner or CEO who would make the final decisions. We don't structure our business like that. We've got a decentralized model. So our turnover is circa 25 million. And that's made up of offices that turn over between 1 and 2 million. And the partners that run those offices will have complete autonomy over how those offices are run. What our job in the central is to oversee the long-term strategic stuff that we talked about in my previous answer, to make sure we kind of know which way the wind's blowing so that we can advise those partners locally to make those decisions. So the decisions we make at board level are quite high level. Lots of the local operating decisions in our business are made by the local partners. And that is akin to how I see things. We don't look to control or make operational decisions. We prefer to take a longer term view on it and get the strategic bits right so that the execution of those can be done locally. So personally, I'm a big advocate of a decentralized model where the strategy is set at quite a senior level, because we're the ones that have the time to look at these things and make sure we're aware of where the markets are going. But operationally, we delegate that decision-making to the partners because we think they're better placed to make those decisions than we would be. They're closer to the clients, closer to the staff. So very much decentralized, very much a model. And it's an extension of delegation, but we've set that in place formally, so all of those decisions are made locally.
Where would you say your leadership style derived from? Did you have a particular role model, or have you been shaped more by circumstance?
I think it actually came, I guess, partly through circumstance. So we had, quite early on in my career, I ended up running an international alliance, which is accountancy firms from around the world coming together to make sure if they have clients that need to trade internationally, they've got contacts around the world. As a result of that, at quite a young age, I got to see lots of different models, lots of different business models. And it became fairly clear to me that if you want to run a big practice, which we now are, one of which is in the UK, you have to find the balance between control and delegation. And it's, I think, in the accountancy space and the legal space, it's really easy to move more towards the delegation model because the quality of people you're working with is really high. It takes a long time to qualify as an accountant or a lawyer. You need a certain level of professionalism and IQ and everything else that goes with it to get to that level. So delegating decisions to professional staff, experienced staff, many of whom are advising other businesses on their own decision making, becomes quite an easy choice. So it was, we selected a business model and then engineered the detail on the back of that. So it was more circumstance, I would say, than my preference. But as a general view, my personal opinion is that having a model that's employee ownership type model where the decisions and a big chunk of the profit exist with local regions makes lots of sense to me anyway. Otherwise, businesses can become unruly and decision-making becomes a little bit disjointed if it's all made from the central. So a mixture of the two, I would say.
Now, unfortunately, our time together is drawing to its close. But before I let you go, what does the next 12 months have in store for TC Group?
Some of it we're in control of. So on a day-to-day basis, more of the same. So we'll be advising and looking after clients as we would normally do. A lot of clients have taken the time to get their private affairs in order. So their wills and their IHT position, something that lots of younger business owners might not have considered. So we're doing more work in that area. In terms of our own growth, we've got mergers and acquisitions that we've already done during lockdown. We've got some more that are due to complete. But medium to longer term, we're expecting more government intervention. You know, the final part of this year, we're hoping some of the schemes that are already in place are extended to certain sectors. So we'll be looking to support clients on that front. And then next year, I think, as I mentioned in one of my earlier answers, the commercial property market, depending on what the government decides to do, could be an area that the owners of commercial property are going to need a lot of support if they have to repurpose those buildings or look at ways that they can repopulate them. So we're hoping, again, the government does something there to encourage people back to the workplace. But if they don't, there's some work to do there. So lots of long tail response to COVID, I suspect we'll be dealing with on behalf of our clients, but for ourselves, we think there's a big growth opportunity in the UK and the wider market. So we'll be continuing to talk to firms, accountants, lawyers, and IFA firms that are looking to develop their business, and we think we can help them with that. So we'll be doing more of those things.
Well, Richard, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on the program. It's been a pleasure to have you. And of course, we have to have you back at some point in the near future. But for now, Richard, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Richard Keys, Chief Executive of TC Group. And now, if you haven't heard it before, is Scott Challoner's exclusive interview with Sir Geoff Hurst.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we extend a very warm welcome to a special guest in Sir Geoff Hurst, who joins us on the program today. Sir Geoff, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good, thank you. It certainly is a wonderful day for it, isn't it?
It is. The weather's pretty good at the moment. I hope may it last.
Absolutely.
Apart from the old thunderstorm, it's lovely.
It is certainly after a storm. And speaking of storms, actually, I'd like to start with just a hypothetical scenario. If we imagine, if we fast forward 2 years, Sir Geoff, let's imagine it's December 2022 and it's the World Cup final and England are there. We could be playing defending champions France, we could be playing the Germans, anybody. And England are 2-0 up in the 90th minute, so victory is all but guaranteed. And Harry Kane, with a brace to his name already, is brought down in the penalty area. So he has the opportunity to make history by emulating yourself and becoming only the second ever player to score a World Cup final hat-trick. Would you honestly want him to bury it, or would you prefer him to fluff his lines?
I'd want him to bury it. I've asked that question, I get that question asked a bit. I've had a good run with this record, and goodness me, that's nearly 60 years, I guess, if we're looking at 2022. No, I'd want him to bury it. A for him, he's a fantastic player. Tremendous goal scorer. And if anybody, I'd like to repeat what I achieved, it would be someone like Harry, who was a fantastic professional with Spurs and England. So absolutely. And I want England to do well. I mean, I want England to be successful. I'm an England supporter. I'm a football supporter. And I really want the country to do well in all sports, and particularly in my sport. So I want him to bury it. And I'd be absolutely... I would be as delighted as anybody in the country if he can achieve that. But more importantly, that England have achieved what we achieved all those years ago. And it's important that the team do it, as opposed to Harry doing it individually. Mm. And that's how I felt about my achievement. It's about the team being successful. Whether I got two or three, in one sense, is I wouldn't say immaterial, but it's about the team winning. It's all about the team.
Mm. Exactly. Consideration of the wider team is a cornerstone of leadership, which is, of course, what the Leaders Council is all about, recognising that and promoting that for the future. But if we sort of flash back 54 years to that moment in 1966 when you were bearing down on goal, I understand that a lot of people always ask you the question about whether you actually knew there were people on the pitch at the time. And there's quite a bit of a joke about that. But there's something else that I'm actually interested in. I understand, we all know what happened, the ball nestled in the top corner, England won 4-2 and lifted the World Cup. But you've often described that as being a mishit finish sometimes before, haven't you?
Yes, I think people... I recall exactly what's amazing. I can recall exactly what I was thinking. At that moment, obviously a crucial moment in the game, towards the end of the game. I knew the game was nearly finished. As the ball came to me initially, I was actually, with my back to goal, I was actually looking at the referee 10 yards from me in the middle of the park, and he was waving at the whistle in his mouth, but waving play on with both arms, indicating quite clearly, of course, that the game was nearly finished. So when I got to the edge of the box, I'm thinking, if the game's nearly finished, I'm now going to whack this ball with everything I've got left. But I'm thinking if it goes beyond the sand, into the crowd, by the time the ball boy gets it back to Hans Stilkowski, the German keeper, by that time, surely the game has got to be over. But as I always jokingly say, I mishit it and it flew in. But I was thinking about wasting time, not so much about... but certainly what I was going to do, which showed, I was going to hit it as hard as I possibly could after those 2 hours.
And it just goes to show sometimes that hit and hope, taking a punt, can sometimes be the way forward, because I think it shows that in any form of leadership, be it in sport or in business, you can't go sometimes without taking risks.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, I wasn't in that position with risk in a sense because the game was unfinished, but that philosophy is right. You're just going to There's an element of risks making it, but it's got to be a control on that risk, not stupid risks in all walks of life. An element of maybe doing something you're not too sure about, but sometimes in life you've got to have a go. You can't be successful in terms of long-term leadership if you're just always sitting on the fence and not taking any chances. I don't think that's where the great leaders will get to by having that kind of philosophy. You've got to move forward.
And the last time that you actually joined us on the Leaders Council podcast and spoke with my colleague Jonathan White to Jeff was back in February, of course, and that was a point where we knew a little bit about COVID-19, which was looming, but that was before it really took hold in the UK and really turned our world upside down. And before that, this summer was meant to be all about the England national team once again, who were going to the European Championships, but that's in a way now been replaced by the National Health Service, and we've been supporting the Health Service and applauding their efforts, and we're hanging out thank you banners displaying drawings of rainbows, very much in the same vein that you'd see the George Cross adorning most households during a major tournament year. Do you feel there are parallels between the sense of national unity that we've discovered during this time and the spirit of 1966?
Oh, absolutely. Particularly the recognition of the NHS with what they're doing. And I think it was a great idea during that period where they asked everybody to stand outside their houses and clap and congratulate the NHS for what they were going through. And I think it's been criticism in the past, of course, the NHS on how it's run, whether there's enough funding for it. And so on. But really, when you begin to realise during these turbulent times how absolutely vital and important it is to have a health service that works efficiently, and to see individually the amount of people who are injured almost every day on the terrible circumstances they were having to work under with masks and so on. And also, it was also, for me, fantastic, all these people from different countries all over the world that were working in our country with the same union to be successful and help people to survive COVID. And very heartwarming. And I think that kind of feeling, I probably, as a player in 66, I probably wasn't aware at that time of the unity of the country. I've learned that over the years when I talk to people who were about 66, and they will tell you what a great day it was and where they were, remembered exactly what they were doing and the fantastic stories. So that identified then as that great unification of the country, 30 million plus viewers, the biggest TV viewing audience we've had. So today, it's certainly through this pandemic, and the NHS has been absolutely magnificent, and every single person, some very fantastic and heartwarming stories of how they're dealing with this unbelievably difficult situation from a health perspective. Fantastic. So that was really heartwarming to get out and cheer and clap on the balcony for the NHS. Fantastic.
Certainly inspiring what we've been seeing from the front line as well. And flashing back just to 1966 again, just from a leadership point of view, the manager that made all of that possible and oversaw yourself and your teammates on the road to the World Cup was, of course, Sir Alf Ramsey. What sets somebody like him or Ron Greenwood apart from other coaches? Because I understand that both men had a profound impact on you, not just as a player, but also as a person as well.
Well, I think that I was very fortunate. You're talking about coincidence and fortunate in your life to be at the time when I was physically at my best during those years. Born earlier or later, I wouldn't have been around physically enough, clever enough, technically good enough to be around, to be a good player. But at that time, I'm involved with arguably the greatest coach we've seen in this country, Harry Redknapp, who's been around a long time, would still say he is the best coach he has worked with. And that's 50 years having been in the business plus. And then moving on to having at national level, a great manager. And the two coincided in a sense, because Ron Greenwood always said that and felt that he, as a coach of a League One club, or Premier League as it is today, it's important you prepare and teach and coach the players to prepare to be playing in the best company, playing for England. And so he prepared us to be playing for England. And then Alf Ramsey knew the players to pick discipline was his big skill, making sure those players were disciplined in the right formation. So the two combined, moving from one to the other, how can you possibly be as fortunate as I was? It was just amazing. So I think Ron was it. I think there are two different aspects of football in terms of leadership. You've got a coach who's a team coach, who's a teacher effectively, and you've got the other kind of character who's a manager who manages people. May not be quite so good technically on the coaching aspects, but by that stage, Ron Green was passing a coach person to Al, who's then managed from a discipline point of view because you're managing people from the whole country. You're not just managing a club. You're managing people, different characters, and all over the country is slightly more demanding job in that respect. So you've got to hone that lot of all over, different characters, strengths, players, into a unit to play for, to represent England. So Alf Ramsey was very good at that. His discipline was fantastic. So the combination of the two, you can't say I can't be as so blessed to be as fortunate as I was to come across these two fantastic people in my life, in my football life.
And I suppose for every Sir Alf Ramsey and Ron Greenwood as well that you have worked with, there are also coaches out there that one might work with that perhaps might not get the best out of players during their, of course, their peak. But just as much as you can learn from, of course, coaches that do get the best out of players, you can learn as much from less effective leaders as you can from good ones as well, because that experience can ultimately mould you as a person, can't it?
Oh, yes. I think leadership's important and coaching and teaching's important. And the great teachers and coaches and managers have that skill. Sometimes it's an innate skill in management. They have it. But I think you can learn, if you're sensible enough, to learn from people who are teaching you or coaching you. It's not the right way to go about teaching or coaching or managing you. You can learn from that. If you're a player, you can learn what you think is a good coach, what you think is a good manager, which you can take into your career after playing into coaching or management. So you can learn as much from people making mistakes. You can learn also from making your own mistakes. Mm. You can do something in the past that think, well, like, that was a really stupid thing to do, and I'll make sure I'm not going to do that again. And it is important in all walks of life. You learn from your mistakes. People will make mistakes. Young people will make mistakes. But it's learning. It's the silly people who make mistakes and don't learn from it, continues making those same mistakes throughout their life and becoming maybe unsuccessful throughout their career.
Completely understand exactly where you're coming from. I think it's almost impossible to become an effective leader in our profession without having that learning curve of making mistakes and learning from them exactly. During Absolutely. Your conversation with Jonathan back in February, Sir Jeff, I know that you and him discussed at length some of the big inspirations and influences on you throughout your career and throughout adulthood. But I understand that your love for football and obsession with the sport actually started a lot earlier, even if you were toing and froing between football and cricket somewhat at the time. I read somewhere that during your teenage years, you were once fined £1 for disturbing the peace after consistently kicking a football into a neighbour's garden. Is that true?
Not many people know that, as the saying goes. Yeah, that's absolutely true. When in those medieval days, there weren't football pitches or place very rarely where you could play. You in our road, in Greenway, as it was called, in Chelmsford, we, that three or four lads, lived quite close to it. It's a cul-de-sac, not a big long road, with a circle at the bottom. So there wasn't a great deal of traffic anyway, A, because it was a cul-de-sac, and B, because there weren't as many cars, in those days. So we played across the road and used to have to learn to chip the ball above the pavement to hit the goal at the back. The goal was about a 2 foot wide semicircular where a tree was planted. That was the goal. And it's always a free ball to play football. But amongst those houses where we lived and played, there was a family and a boy that didn't play football. I think he was interested in flying, you know, and making balsa wood gliders. And nice guy, but just didn't play football. And on this particular garden, of course, occasionally the ball finished up there. And crazily enough, they took us to court. And we actually got fined. This is absolutely true. We got fined £1 for kicking the ball in the neighbour's garden. Astounding when you think about it, isn't it? And when there's nowhere else to play apart from the street. And we were actually... But that happens. that happens. You'll hear stories. We see stories of neighbours falling out over different things. You see those stories every day. But that was certainly a true story. Absolutely true.
And during that time, who was it during childhood that you really looked up to, that you thought was an inspiration to you and made you really think that going into professional sport was going to be the route for you?
Well, my father was obviously the biggest inspiration for me because he was an ex-player. He played lower down for Oldham Rochdale. We actually moved south from Manchester. I was born in Ashton-under-Lyne. We actually moved south to Chelmsford when I was probably, I was the eldest of three, when I was probably about 7 or 8, into this particular street called Greenways. And what he did with me, I think, was had a big influence, going back to that third gold in the World Cup, in many years in the back garden. And when we moved up market to a council house somewhere in Chelmsford, and he would have me in the back garden teaching me to kick with my left foot. And so I, at that time, and even today, it's you don't see that many players that are completely two-footed, and I was. Maybe not as two-footed as Bobby Charlton. Even Jack Charlton, his brother, didn't know which was his best foot. He was fantastic. But I was pretty two-footed, and a lot of the hat-tricks I scored were one right, one left, and a header. So he had a huge influence. I wasn't a child, although I had a footballing father. I wasn't a child whose father pushed him into being a footballer. He and what happened with my story is a friend of my father, I know the guy's name, called Jock Redfern, unbeknownst to me, he wrote to two clubs for a trial. He wrote to Arsenal and he wrote to West Ham United when I was just after school leaving age. West Ham replied. They asked me to come for a trial. I went for a trial with them, and they saw something in me and took me on the what was called the ground staff then, almost at school leaving age. And so I wasn't necessarily thinking I've got to go into football. It's just that that's how it happened. Although I enjoyed football and I was pretty reasonably good, there was no big focus on me as a great schoolboy player. Nobody was scouting me or writing to my parents saying, come and have a trial at this club or that club. But a friend of my father wrote the letter. So that's how it happened. The problem I had during those early years, I enjoyed cricket as well, and I was messing about, as I kind of put it, between the two sports, which was hugely detrimental to me in my early development, either as a cricketer or either as a footballer. And it wasn't until Ron Greenwood miraculously tried me. I was a midfield player then, or centre-half at school. Said I'm going to try you up front. He put me up front in the game, and then my whole football career and life changed dramatically.
And I suppose as well, what might have also done it for football as opposed to cricket was that fateful match for Essex over in Egberth against Lancashire, wasn't it?
Yes, a lot of people know that. One game, the sort of went messing about between the two. I had one first-class game for Essex, as you said, Egberth in Liverpool. And I think I got Norton not out, I think. So, I mean, we won the game, funny. I filled a couple of catches, but Essex actually won the game v Lancashire up in their territory. But that was a real problem for me. I think I could have done some advice maybe earlier to say, make your mind up. But when you look back, even today, cricket goes through till, September, whereas football starts in July, so there's a huge overlap. And I'm still playing cricket until September, missing pre-season, early games for those 2 or 3 years, extremely detrimental to me doing well at one or the other. Until Ron Greenwood just put me up front, and that was it. And from a standing start, I think my first season around, I think September, October, I played my first game up front against Liverpool. And I think I played about 27, 28 games and scored 14 goals, like 1 in 2 from a standing start for a midfield player. So quite changed dramatically. That was 62-63 season, 3 years before the World Cup.
And when we think about leadership in football, the role of a goalkeeper, of course, not related to your own career, is to essentially build from the back and command his penalty area. And one goalkeeper that you played with, not just for England, but also for Stoke City in the later years in your career, was Gordon Banks. I have to confess, as a boyhood Port Vale supporter, I am relieved that incredible talents like yourself and Gordon are no longer occupying the dressing room there. And I did have the fortune of meeting Gordon when I was a young boy as well. But what was Gordon like as a leader on the field?
Well, first of all, he was a great, two things for Gordon. He was a great keeper. I would still say the greatest English keeper we've ever had, and one of the best keepers in the world. Absolutely fantastic. Funny enough, I didn't realise, it's funny how you look at, I saw when Gordon passed away, naturally, you know, sadly, a few months ago, and they were showing a lot of videos of Banksy. Programs about Banksy and the great saves he made and the save against Pelé and so on. But I didn't realise how athletic he was, how quick he was, athletic, springing forward to smother balls, and not just hitting balls. Agility-wise, he was absolutely fantastic. But as a character, he was a joker. He was a very kind, very mild-mannered, lovely man, the nicest guy you can possibly wish to meet. But he was a joker. He always had a joke for you. Every time you met sometime, he'd have a new joke. And people talk about him and who are close to him will remember what a joker he was. And they're the two things that really stick out for Banksy. And we were very lucky, of course, to have that kind of quality as a world-class player. When you win a World Cup, you need four or five players, which we were very fortunate to have in our team. Banksy is one of the world-class players, along with Bobby Moore and Bobby Charlton. Jimmy Greaves, who didn't play, was a world-class player, but in the squad. And Ray Wilson, our left-back, I'd always argue, was a world-class player. So you need that kind of quality initially if you're going to be successful in winning a World Cup, some world-class players. And Banksy was up there, not with the best for me.
And another thing from during your days at Stoke City as well was that a talented but then troubled young midfielder by the name of Alan Hudson first joined the club around the early 70s. And I know that you were asked to take him in as a lodger to provide him with a stable home during his spell there by then manager Tony Waddington. Now, I've spoken to a great many directors and executives on this programme before, and all of them describe trust as being a key cornerstone of leadership. How did it feel for you knowing that Waddington trusted you to that degree to ask that of you?
Well, I was extremely flattered. It was a huge compliment that he saw me as a, and of course over the years, hopefully that had come out. That's important that you have those kind of qualities as a player that A, he saw when I was at West Ham, and B, obviously he acquired me to play at Stoke City. So I was initially first fairly surprised, I think it is. And certainly my wife was fairly surprised when I said I'd need her permission for me to allow Alan Hudson to stay with us in those early periods. But what he saw, of course, in me was, which is, I can see in myself, I was a very disciplined person, a very disciplined player, which you have to be. I didn't really have, I would say, the qualities of the world-class players like the Bobby Charltons and the Jimmy Greaves and the Bobby Moores. So you need to bring all the other characteristics to be successful at that level, to compete in their level. And discipline was one of them. And obviously, Tony Waddington saw that. And if he wanted to he trusted me that I was disciplined enough to hopefully push some of my discipline into Alan Hudson, which we did. And in those early 6 months and a couple of years, he was come up a bit heavier from Chelsea. He lost a bit of weight. And although he was a little bit indisciplined himself, hence they needed him to stay with me, what he was a fantastic player. He is one of the most fantastic players I think I've come across, but not hit the best because I think he was a certain slightly bit of ill discipline within his general life. And you need at the top, and I'm talking at the top being an England player, but I'd compare him purely on ability compared with ability up in the Franz Beckenbauer mold. Mm. Without any shadow of a doubt, he was that good. So it was a bit of fun and enjoyable times, serving Alan Hudson the cups of tea about 8 o'clock at night when we had our tea at our home for those few months. And I think he was a big help to getting Alan back on track and performing brilliantly for the club.
And following on from your days with the Potters, you went on, of course, to play football in Ireland and the United States before the end of your career. Did you feel that the dressing room and indeed leadership culture at those clubs differed from perhaps what you've been used to back in England?
Well, I think Ireland was just a silt spell with Cork Celtic, so it's hard to judge and make any comparisons. And of course, in America, it was the early days of football in America, and I thoroughly enjoyed my time at Seattle, so it's difficult to make a comparison. I think I was fortunate at West Ham that it was a great time for the club, and I was fortunate to play with Stoke City for 3 years, and it was a fantastic time for that particular club. They'd won, of course, the League Cup before I went there. Sadly, they knocked us out in the semi-final. So it was a marvellous time for that particular club. And very close, we actually, I think we played Ajax in the following year in Europe. I think we only lost on a goal over the two games against Ajax. So it was a great time for the club. So I'm very fortunate to have played for those two clubs. Only a short spell at West Brom, of course, but I think, as I always jokingly say, I think I was past my sell-by date then. West Brom was a fantastic club, but I wasn't at my best, and I thought it was time to retire, which I did. And Johnny Giles was in charge then. I think West Brom actually got up that year, but I made very little contribution to that success the club had. So, yes, the American experience was just fantastic. I never saw it as long-term being over there. That was a brilliant few months with my wife and two daughters, and my wife, Angie, was pregnant with her third daughter over there. So that was a good time. It's completely different. Ireland was just a. I always joke about Ireland. I was there for about, I think, a month, I think it was, and I enjoyed the experience, and I earned a few quid, and I think it paid for the kitchen in one of my houses back in England. New kitchen.
So it certainly went really well. I suppose in the waning days of your career, was it humbling that you realised that people were beginning to actually look up to you and be inspired by you as a legend, as in perhaps the same way that you were looking to the likes of Bobby Moore earlier on in your career?
Yeah, so I think that kind of, whatever the correct word is, I don't know, being looked at and revered sort of comes maybe longer, not some sort of immediately after you've finished playing, but in the long term when... and I always joke with people, introduce me to other people or introduce me on stage as a legend. And I always jokingly say, you only start being called a legend when you're over 70. And I think the whatever the word is, I'm not sure, adulation or recognition or whatever, it sort of happens and you think more about it, or it happens and occurs more in later years. Not certainly I felt during the time after I finished playing or managing or playing for England during my football career. And I think I went into business for 20 years, and I don't think anybody necessarily looked at me when I was in business as necessarily a legend or somebody they could look up. So I felt that kind of attitude probably has happened in my later years, probably.
For those younger generations, just lastly, Sir Geoff, before we do wrap things up, for people who are aspiring to become leaders in business, politics, sport, or indeed any walk of life, if you could offer any advice to them based upon your experience, what advice would you give them?
Simple advice in a sentence is really, I learned a lot from Alf Ramsey. He was a boss. I think a boss sometimes have natural characteristics. You can learn about management or management courses. But there's certain characteristics when the successful boss is within them to start with. But one of the things I learned from Alf Ramsey, which I've taken into my business life and even my talk to my family life, if they're involved in business, is when you're managing people, you manage them as a group. Anybody that doesn't want to be part of that group, you find is backing against what you want to achieve as a boss, you move them out. And I think that's one of the most simple lessons I learned during the Alf Ramsey period. Even some of the great players I felt should have been in the squad, possibly at the time, without mentioning names. And you hear stories about this player not, you know, completely complying with everything, and they're left out or they're not even in the squad. And I felt that was, and even some with great ability, I think probably didn't make it. And I think a lot of it stems down to they wanted to be, you know, a lone champion, successful person. didn't want to be part of the group. So that for me is the key message, the single key message I would pass on to anybody who wants to manage a group of people in any walk of life.
Ties in very nicely with a quote from one Nelson Mandela, in fact, that surround yourself with people who are better than you are in some ways. And I think that is incredibly sound advice indeed.
Yes, it is. Very good. Good advice, yes.
So, Jeff, thank you ever so much for joining us on the programme this morning. It's been an absolute pleasure having you with us to discuss your life, career and leadership. And it would be a pleasure to welcome you back on the programme in future to discuss further.
Pleasure. Thank you. Enjoy being part of the programme. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you ever so much for your time again.
This has been the Leaders Council podcast. Thank you for celebrating excellence in leadership with us. I have been your host, Matthew O'Neill. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you for listening to our podcast. The views expressed within the podcast do not reflect the views of the Leaders' Council of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, its parent company or subsidiaries, members of staff, other guests, or any other person therein associated.